is next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program, and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And we are going to be spending this portion of WGTD's Morning Show learning about a harrowing expedition that occurred in the early 1880s when a small group of American explorers sought to reach farther north, closer to the North Pole than any other human beings had ever reached at that point in time. We are talking about the Greely Polar Expedition, and we're talking about a book called Labyrinth of Ice, The Triumphant and Tragic Greely Polar Expedition. As that subtitle suggests, this is an expedition that ended rather badly. And this account of what this expedition was like and the terrible challenges and conditions which these men faced is told in riveting fashion. And I so appreciate the great work of its author, Buddy Levy, who is the author of a number of different books that have explored various important figures in our history, including various expeditions somewhat similar to this. He is the author, for instance, of River of Darkness, Francisco Orellana's A Legendary Voyage of Death and Discovery Down the Amazon, and co-author of No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon, and Geronimo, Leadership Strategies of an American Warrior. This book, published by St. Martin's Press, again is titled Labyrinth of Ice, The Triumphant and Tragic Greely Polar Expedition. And Buddy Levy, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
One of the first questions I want to ask you is to give us a sense of what was available to you in order to tell this amazing story in such meticulous detail. It's just incredible how much you are able to tell us about this expedition, which occurred back in the years 1881 to 1884. And I think most of us would assume that when a trip like that is undertaken, where there are just the matter of sheer survival is of utmost concern, that that little, if anything, would remain from such an expedition to be helpful to an author like you coming along, 140 years later. And obviously, you had considerable resources to which you could turn. Give us some sense of the legacy of this Greely expedition, which could serve as the basis for your meticulously researched book.
Right. So I benefited greatly by Greely's incredible thoroughness. And not so there, first of all, it was an army expedition, and Greely as commander took great, it was an army expedition and a scientific expedition, first and foremost. And so Greely spent a great deal of time each and every day recording everything from the weather patterns to which men were doing what in the command to the successes and failures of their journeys from the Fort Conger way up to the north. And so for 2 full years, they were taking, you know, over 500 scientific readings a day, and a number of the men kept meticulous diaries, and a number of the men were writing not only personal diaries, letters back home, field notes, and at a certain point, not to give too much away too early, Greeley determines that they must strike from their comfortable fort, which is up near the top of Canada and Greenland, at a place on Ellesmere Island, and he is adamant that they take all of their records with them. They're boxed in crates, and so it was really the result of Greeley's great desire to have the record of their journey given to the world that I and other researchers before me have benefited from this wealth of literature. And so that's the primary, sources are, you know, letters, field notes, and then official reports written by Greeley and some of his other officers, which allow you to know on a daily basis, you know, what, even what the weather was like as they're either looking outside the fort, later a tent or some other crude structure they have cobbled out of the ground. And so that's really, really helpful. And unusual, you know, because in a lot of these polar expeditions, everything is lost.
Right. And fortunately, we have quite a lot to look at. And there are some photographs as well. So a photographer obviously was along as well.
Right. So a gentleman named George Rice, a Canadian photographer, came along. And he's instrumental in this journey in a number of ways, but not the least of which is his remarkable photography. So I think in the book there are some 40 or 50 images, most of which are taken by George Rice. And again, you know, they took great pains to carry these plates in secured crates and boxes along with them, which was really arduous, you know, because ultimately they're having to pull these crates on sleds along, not only, you know, with their diminishing food stores. And, you know, Greeley is often wondering, and he asks the men, should we leave this stuff behind because it's a great burden? And they all agree that they need to take it with them. Hmm.
This is an expedition which was undertaken in 1881. So this is at a point in time when I believe nobody has reached the North Pole, nobody has reached the South Pole, but explorers have probed very far south and very far north. And this particular mission, I believe, was a threefold mission, one of those purposes of this mission was to try to reach farther north than any other human being was known to have reached. So how far north had human beings gone before this? And so what were the Americans trying to achieve in that respect?
Right. Well, so, excuse me, that's really interesting because the farthest north element of the story was really Greeley's independent secret desire. And so you mentioned the three goals. So first and foremost, this journey was scientific, and it was part of this international, very visionary international consortium of a dozen research stations circumnavigating the polar regions all around the world. And Greeley's was the northernmost of all of these. So at the time they're dropped off at what they called Fort Conger, which was you know, a 65-foot-long prefabbed wooden structure that they unloaded from the ship and then built there. At that point, they're the northernmost inhabitants in the world, actually. And so Greeley, knowing this, the other thing they were supposed to do was try to find any remnants or record of this USS Jeannette that had gone missing 2 years prior, and they Greeley was supposed to look and see if he could figure out where these men were. He actually knew Captain DeLong. But knowing he was going to be this far north already, Greeley conspired to try to break this 300-year-old record of farthest north, which was just over 80 degrees north latitude at the time. And they're about 400 miles south of the North Pole, though, as you mentioned, no one had ever been there before. And what's really interesting to me is that there was a great deal of confusion about what it was like up there. In fact, there were some people who believed that once you broke through this ring of ice circumnavigating the North Pole, that it was actually a tropical open polar sea. And some previous voyages had gone up there, you know, carrying, and they believed that there were palm trees. And Greeley harbored no such delusions. But at any rate, he was really hell-bent on trying. He was very patriotic and very nationalistic, and he was hell-bent on trying to break this record that had been held by British forays north. And so the minute he got up to Fort Conger, built the fort, and had everyone comfortably ensconced doing their science, he began to send out small teams of 2 to 3 men, usually Brainerd and Lockwood, two of his trusted men, and then a Greenlandic dog sled driver, and they would strike north.
One of the points you make about Lieutenant A.W. Greeley, who led this expedition and for whom it is named, is the fact that he had considerable experience, but very little, if any, experience when it came to specifically exploring the Arctic. And I believe, if I remember correctly, he also had no nautical experience. Tell us a bit more about what his background was, what he really was equipped to do, and then maybe a word about his shortcomings in terms of experience when it came to something as arduous as this particular expedition.
Right. So it's a great question, and it's one of the criticisms that Greeley sometimes receives and has received through history. So he enlisted in the Army when he was like 17 years old, and fought. He was a Civil War veteran, had been injured in the Civil War. He was a career Army man. He then ended up moving his way up the ranks and was working for the Signal Corps, and had been doing really great work setting up telegraph lines in the American Southwest. And he began to, he was sort of fascinated with the polar north and expeditions, and had read widely about them. And he learned of this expedition that was being conceived by this Austrian man named Karl Weyprecht, who he was the one who decided that it would be useful for the world to know more about the polar regions. And so Greeley managed to get himself chosen as the leader of this expedition. And you're right, it was, they were in many ways ill-suited. They were not, it was not a naval operation. Most of the men had been under Greeley at the Signal Corps and in the Army, and they were on the plains on horseback just prior to embarking on this incredible voyage into these ice-choked seas. And McGreeley was a very, very quick learner. He was incredibly dutiful commander. You mentioned his shortcomings. He's a complicated figure in that as a career Army man, orders were paramount in his mind, and not following orders meant essentially chaos and mutiny. And so, you know, he ran an incredibly tight outfit. But he also, there was one thing that was interesting, it becomes interesting later, is that he had poor vision. So he's always mentioned in images, he's got these oval spectacles. And this becomes important as there, when you're moving through what are called leads, which are these sort of narrow highways of water snaking through ice-burdened seas, you really need to be able to stand in the front of a craft and see your way through. And at a certain point, you know, Greeley is, and one of the things I remark on is his ability to sort of shift his leadership style as necessary, because he realizes that his vision is an impediment, and that if he doesn't let someone else with better vision do the ice piloting, as it's called, that they're all going to be crushed by the ice and die. But so, yeah, I mean, I really talk about his leadership style in a number of ways, because he makes some decisions along the way that become questioned not only by historians but by his men at the time, and it's fascinating to see him adapt.
Absolutely, and one of the things that we read here, besides kind of the matters of what ultimately becomes a desperate struggle just to survive, but also his struggle to maintain order, to deal with, in a sense, insurrection among certain key figures in this group. I mean, it is one thing to exert leadership and authority under sort of normal circumstances, but when one is many thousands of miles away from civilization, so to speak, leadership becomes a very different sort of challenge, and a very, very difficult challenge in many, many ways.
Right, and so I look at the expedition in sort of two main parts, which is their time at Fort Conger, when they have, you know, this incredibly comfortable double-walled fort with outbuildings that are serving as their scientific base. They've got a coal seam up there. They've got, you know, heat. They can heat this building. And they're, even then, they're confronted with, you know, wolf attacks, and they endure 100-mile-an-hour winds and -100-degree temperatures, but they have the fort, and they're also contending with this thing called the Long Night, which is the polar darkness that descends around October 15th at that latitude, and then the sun doesn't rise again until February 15th. So you've got this psychological burden of darkness and cabin fever, and Greeley is amazing at he creates a kind of school where he's teaching mathematics and science and meteorology, and he's giving lectures, and he has the men competing in foot races and snowshoe races and shooting competitions under the flaring aurora borealis. And then the second part is when he makes the very momentous decision to leave Fort Conger at per his instructions and orders, which creates some division among the men. And then they have to strike 250 miles south to where they believe the rescue or resupply will come, and that's been preordained. And so then that part, then it becomes a matter of survival, and they're out exposed on ice floes, and they, for months, they're moving southward, and Greeley has to really change his approach at a certain point, where he decides to have meetings with the officers and men who've been, you know, surfacing as great leaders, and then ask their opinions and actually have a kind of democratic approach to whatever they're going to do, because each decision at this point means their lives.
We're speaking with Buddy Levy and talking about his new book, Labyrinth of Ice, The Triumphant and Tragic Greeley Polar Expedition. I don't think we've yet really spelled out the dire straits in which this expedition finds itself at a point in time when things begin to go drastically wrong, thanks mostly to Mother Nature. Explain, at least in brief, what goes wrong with the expedition and what puts these men in such grave peril.
Right. So, well, as they're moving south from Fort Conger to this area that they're meant to reach called Cape Sabine. At this point, they've got a steamship, which is only 28 feet long, and they're towing a number of whale boats. And they're moving through this wind-swept and wavy body of water that if you fall into, if you're there for a minute or so, you're going to die. And then what happens is all the ice is ever moving, and so they're having to lift all of their stuff periodically up onto these ice floes and icebergs. And at one point, they're stranded on an iceberg that is actually being crushed by other icebergs, and they're on it for weeks and weeks, and they've got dwindling food stores. So Greeley has to take an account of their rations and determine how long they can live on diminished rations. And then when they finally manage to reach Cape Sabine, they come to realize that all of these rescue efforts and resupplies that were meant to leave things for them, for one reason or another that they don't know yet, have failed to reach them. And now they're stranded on a barren shore with very little food and virtually no shelter, and they have to figure out how to live until the following spring. And they arrive there in the late fall, and the light is about to go out.
It's impossible to even imagine what it would be like to be confronted by circumstances so terribly grim. And of course, much of your book chronicles exactly that, what it is like to be attempting to survive something that would seem to be a completely hopeless situation. One thing we have not yet mentioned is the fact that this book is not only a chronicle of Greeley and his men on this expedition, but is also a chronicle of what is going on back home. Because this is an expedition that is generating news headlines. And it is also, of course, a point of enormous concern for one Henrietta Greeley. Tell our listeners about her, who she was, and the role that she plays in this story.
Right. So I'm really glad you brought that up, because Henrietta Greeley, Greeley had met her while he was working the Signal Corps in San Diego, and she was an affluent woman, the daughter of a banker. And so she was not really that thrilled when Greeley decided to head off on this expedition, because everyone knew, Greeley and Henrietta were both very well read, and they knew that crew losses of polar expeditions were average 50%. So it was not, the odds weren't that great. But the resupply ships failed to get to him, and she learns this because they're under the aegis of the U.S. Army. She begins this effort, really tireless effort, to create a kind of national interest in her husband's expedition and the fact that the U.S. government is responsible for them and needs to act. And so she is just tireless in her efforts to write to and have her brother, who is connected to U.S. newspapers across the country, create this these editorials saying that something needs to happen, and she works at this and works at this until finally, even going so far as to write letters to the President of the United States, to Robert Todd Lincoln, who is Abraham M. Lincoln's eldest son, who is the Secretary of War, so that in the end they can't drag their feet any longer, because the Secretary of War was not very keen on polar expeditions in the first place. Ultimately, you have a naval expedition that is launched with assistance from the British Admiralty, who offer a ship, and you get this other. So I bounce back and forth between the men stranded on an iceberg and then the halls of Congress where they're arguing about whether to go, what to do, and it creates a kind of tension, and then cut to Lady Henrietta Greeley, who is working every day to try to make sure something happens. And it's really, I mean, I think it's kind of riveting to move back and forth between these happenings.
Absolutely. Well, and to have this sense that back home, they are in no position to know exactly what is going on with the Greeley expedition. And of course, we know, but they don't know. Or they don't know exactly or precisely what is going on, what has befallen this expedition. And, of course, one can also appreciate the fact that when one sends a rescue expedition of any kind, you are placing those men in the path of great peril as well. I mean, it is something that should not be done lightly. I mean, what a difficult situation for everyone involved.
Right, and the other thing that I found really compelling is that once these rescue missions are dispatched, you've got Greeley and his men literally clinging to an iceberg that's being reduced by other icebergs bashing into it, and then ships that are moving northward from Newfoundland and up through the Labrador Sea and the Cane Basin trying to get to them, and neither of which knows where the other are, but you have this really, really great system of correspondence that they used back then. They called sort of Arctic post offices. So they would leave, they'd build rock cairns at different places on islands on prominent points, and they would leave written messages under these cairns. And so you've got Greeley and his men discovering certain things about where caches of food are supposed to be, and then the rescue missions trying to find out more information or any information about Greeley's whereabouts. And at some points, these they get very tantalizingly close to one another. And then there are shipwrecks that occur within the rescue missions, as you mentioned. And so you've got men scattered in different places, and it becomes just this harrowing fight for life by all involved.
Right. And of course, it's always important for us to remember that we're talking about 1882, 1883, 1884, and the technology available at that time, which was next to nothing when it comes to matters of exploring in such dangerous environments. It reminds us that it's sort of amazing that any human being would make such an attempt in the first place. And it's really equally amazing that anybody would follow in their footsteps, not knowing what kind of peril they were going to be confronting.
But really, I look at it very much akin to space exploration. You know, they were going places that were very, it was the unknown, you know, and it was about discovery. And so I really think that's what they're driven by, not only the national pride of some arbitrary record, but by, you know, Greeley and his men discovered places or went to places that had never before been stepped on by humans. And so it's a little bit like landing on the moon, you know. And so I really, I was also just moved by that desire to find out what's beyond, and then, you know, of course, the ability to survive in these elements that make us realize now, with all of our comforts and down and Gore-Tex, that maybe these people were just tougher than we are.
Well, we're going to leave it to our listeners to find out the final fate of the expedition by reading your book. I will say this much: some people do survive. To what extent was this a huge story at the time, and what ultimately was the public reaction to the Greeley expedition?
Right. Well, let me say a couple of things. One, it was an enormous story, making world headlines, without saying too much, that, you know, when there's an amazing rescue, and some of the men return national and even global heroes, and But beyond that, I wanted to add that, you know, the subtitle, The Triumphant and Tragic Polar Expedition, there's a great deal of humanity in this story, too. There's patriotism, there's heroism, there's men doing selfless acts of endurance for the group that I think we can learn a lot from. And so it's not only a sort of sensational foray into tragedy, but it's really about how people can work together under very trying circumstances and figure out ways to help one another, even, you know, at their own peril. So I just wanted to add that.
It's an astonishing story. And again, I'm amazed that there is so much available to you in order to tell this story in such remarkable detail. The book again is called it's called Labyrinth of Ice, The Triumphant and Tragic Greeley Polar Expedition, published by St. Martin's Press, and the author, Buddy Levy. Buddy Levy, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show, and thank you for giving the world such a fantastic book.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
And to give you a little taste of this book, Labyrinth of Ice, here is a portion of the prologue. Again, the author is Buddy Levy. September 1st, 1883. Expedition Commander Lieutenant Adolphus W. Greeley stood on the edge of the ice floe, listening to the constant groan and roar of the ice pack, a sound so eerily hideous that it had come to be known by Arctic explorers as the Devil's Symphony. Not even the howling wind, which was pushing out to sea the small ice floe Greeley and his 24 men were stranded on, away from their destination, could drown out the weird and terrible sound of the pack. Ice grinding against ice, shearing and shrieking and wailing, an ever-present reminder of their desperate vulnerability in this colossal and hostile environment. He and his men were mere specks, adrift on a small island of ice, moving at the mercy of the tide and winds. Two of their boats had been hauled up onto the ice, and a third, the 10,000-pound steam launch Lady Greeley, had been made fast to the side of the Floeberg with ice anchors. Greeley consulted with the meteorologist, who took readings through the blowing snow. It was 11 degrees Fahrenheit. No polar party had ever recorded a lower temperature this early in the year. Greeley surveyed the desolate surroundings between Ellesmere Island and Greenland. To the west, on the Ellesmere Island side of Lower Kane Basin, were rugged, rocky cliffs, and beyond them the snow-capped Victoria and Albert Mountains rose high above. To the east were the foggy fjords and mist-shrouded peaks rising from the Greenland shore. Everything and everyone, all the gear and boats and men, were encrusted with a veneer of frost. They had made it to within 30 miles above Cape Sabine, the location where Greeley, through prearranged and explicitly written military orders, had instructed relief ships to deposit food for his expeditionary force. But for the last few days, they had been drifting slowly away from land and back toward the north, away from shore and the food cache that Greeley hoped would be their salvation. His men were exhausted from 3 weeks of nearly constant motion, their hands raw and bleeding inside their sealskin mittens from pulling at the oars and from hauling the boats on and off icebergs every day, or sometimes every hour. Their shoulders were sore and blistered from the drag ropes. Men shivered, nearly hypothermic, as they fought for sleep bivouacked directly on the ice or hunkered in the bottoms of their uncovered small craft. Greeley took his trusted sergeant, David Brainerd, aside, and they carefully inventoried their dwindling stores, counting the various meats, including beef and bacon, plus the hardtack bread. There were rations for perhaps 50 days, maybe a week longer if the hunters could shoot seals, walruses, or bears. The expedition had already been through tremendous trials. Together, more than 200 miles to the north, they had confronted by and survived every possible challenge. Attacks by wolves, hurricane-force winds, temperatures approaching 100 degrees below zero, and near insanity brought on by the months of total darkness. Following orders 3 weeks earlier, Greeley had commanded his men to abandon the comforts of Fort Conger, which they had built above an inlet at the far northeastern shore of Ellesmere Island. They had turned away from the fort's coal-burning cook stove, its fireplace, insulated walls, and protective roof, and a year's supply of food, and traveled by boats into the ice-choked seas, heading south towards Cape Sabine. Navigating the roiling chop and massive bergs through mist and fog, sleet and snow, and dying autumn light had been treacherous. And although Greeley would not admit it, his poor eyesight was making navigation nearly impossible. He needed a better set of eyes to do the ice piloting. Ultimately, with ice pressing in on them from all sides, Greeley had made the decision to commit the boats and men to the mercies of the floes, with the forlorn hope that tides and winds would propel them south to Cape Sabine. If that failed, they would abandon everything not essential and attempt to cross ice bridges from floe to floe until they reached land. Some of Greeley's men disagreed with him, muttering that his decisions were madness and amounted to suicide. One of the men said he feared another Franklin disaster. The expedition doctor scribbled furiously in his journal, "It is terrible to float in this manner, in the snow, fog, and dark. This seems to me like a nightmare," in one of Edgar Allan Poe's stories. And in many ways, it was. A portion of the prologue to Buddy Levy's amazing book, Labyrinth of Ice, The Triumphant and Tragic Greeley Polar Expedition, published by St. Martin Press. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part 2 is coming up in just a moment. And for this portion of the morning show, we're going to be talking about a wonderful new series of books that are coming to us from National Geographic, and specifically as part of a series that is devoted to young readers, a brand new fiction series which kicks off with Zeus the Mighty, The Quest for the Golden Fleas. And the talented author who is responsible for this is Christian Boyer, who has a number of different books to his credit for National Geographic Kids, and that is the division of this publishing house devoted to young readers. And we're going to find out more about the work that he has done already with National Geographic and with the fun that can be had with this new series inspired by Greek mythology. Crispin Boyer, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us, first of all, what does it take to be a successful author for young readers? Maybe another way to ask that is, what do you think it is about you as a writer with your own talents and gifts that makes you so well-suited to do this?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because when I started out as a writer, I actually started out as a newspaper reporter covering county commissioner meetings and the police beat, and it was certainly not the kind that lent itself to young readers. And maybe there was something that I only did that for about 2 years before I wanted to move on to something else, maybe something a little more fun that wasn't so much about, you know, county health department meetings and talking about easements and the bickering commissioners of local politics. Maybe something about that did lend itself to the types of stories that maybe kids would enjoy, just some of the basics and some of the characters that I ran across. But also, for a while, I worked in I wrote for video games, which is also for young readers, too. So I think just part of it is maybe, too, that I just never really grew up and it just I just had kind of a silly sense of humor, and You know, this is the Zeus the Mighty, this series that I'm working on now, is my first fiction series, and this is after being a nonfiction writer for about 20 years. So I think it was just, also I spent a lot of time writing a lot of books for kids that were about science and history and you know, weather and dinosaurs, and I learned a lot of stuff just kind of going in one ear onto the page and out the other that I could help me, like, kind of, you know, it come to this, like, a larger story now to focus on fiction for kids.
Right. Was it your idea or somebody else at National Geographic to create a fiction series for young readers based in Greek mythology?
Well, it was actually my boss's idea at National Geographic. Her name is Becky Baines. And when they started this new fiction initiative there, they call it, we call it fact-based fiction, because while it is fiction and while it's entertaining, it's based on, you know, real history. There's another series that was before this called The Explorer Academy that was about technology and science, and they decided they wanted to focus on something that was more about history and mythology. And Becky's idea was to do it in a pet rescue center where the animals all basically took the place of the Greek gods. So that was kind of the overall world. She came up with Zeus and the characters, and then she turned the idea over to me because I've been an author for quite a while and said, here, you have fun with this. And I was very happy that she did that because it's a really fun world to play in at Mount Olympus Pet Rescue Center.
Absolutely. Let's start with that really intriguing premise, because that's, in a sense, kind of the home base where most of these characters sort of live and where a lot of this sort of begins. Tell us how you came up with the idea for the Mount Olympus Pet Center and what it's like.
Sure. Yeah, happy to. So it's a pet rescue in Athens, Georgia, so it's not really in Greece. It's high on a hill, and it's run by a woman named Artemis, and the animals all call her Artie. And she's based off Artemis, the Greek goddess who is protector of the animals. She is a huge fan of Greek mythology, and she rescues these animals. And whenever she's working at the pet rescue center during the day, you know, maybe she's scraping the algae off the aquariums or feeding the animals or straightening up racks of ball chuckers and dog toys and things, she puts on a podcast that's called Greeking Out, because she's a big fan of Greek mythology. And then The Greeking Out is a podcast that's hosted by the Oracle of Wi-Fi, who then explains these Greek myths. Now, the animals, for, you know, this is where you kind of suspend your disbelief, can understand the podcast. And they hear these stories, and they think that they really are the Greek gods. It's not a matter that they pretend that they're the Greek gods. They really think so. There's Zeus the hamster, who really thinks that he is Zeus, the king of the gods. He's got a friend, a grasshopper named Demeter, who thinks that she is the Greek goddess of harvest. There's Athena the cat, who thinks that she is Athena, the goddess of wisdom. And then there's Ares the pug, who's kind of a little, he's a little troublemaker, and he thinks he's Ares, the god of war. So every night, whenever Artie leaves, the animals go on adventures, basically recreating the adventures that they hear from the Oracle of Wi-Fi. So, and they see the Pet Rescue Center as being really ancient Greece. They see, when they look at the aquarium section, they see the Aegean Sea. They'll see the mountains will stand in for, you know, the shelves. You know, Zeus lives on Mount Olympus, which is just the highest shelf in the store. So there's kind of a fun little game to play when you're reading the book, you know, what the animals see as, like, mountains or monsters are actually just, you know, it'll be a floor fan or it'll be a display of frisbees. So it's just kind of a fun way for them to interpret their world and for the reader to see, to think about, like, what are they looking at? Why do they see what they see? And the book has really, really good illustrations that kind of bring everything home to life, too.
Absolutely, and that makes a really, really big difference. So in other words, these animals are taking literally the way in which they have been whimsically named by Artie, the caretaker of this pet center. I mean, so this hamster, for instance, really believes he is Zeus because, of course, that's what he's named. And
yes.
I think a really fun example of what you're talking about in terms of the way they look at what we would think of as ordinary objects and pieces of furniture and view them through the lens of, my word, this is This is the world of Greek mythology, is what the adventure they have in the first chapter with what they believe to be an encounter with a very, very deadly creature out of mythology. Tell our listeners about this.
Yeah, well, just to kind of set the how the whole series works, I wanted to start the story with an adventure with a monster. So there's Charybdis, who in Greek mythology is basically a giant whirlpool that just sucks down ships, and it's Jason from Jason the Argonauts deals with him, Odysseus deals with him. He's kind of a famous monster. So Zeus, of course, wants to banish this creature from Greece because he's dangerous to the shipping and sailors. You know, Zeus kind of sees himself as protector of the realm. So he comes up across this giant whirlpool monster, and of course, what in a pet center would be a whirlpool monster? Well, the closest thing that Zeus might find to that would be a toilet that is stuck in perpetual flush. So what he comes across the shop restroom that's got, that's stuck running and thinks it's a giant whirlpool monster, it's just the toilet, and then he must defeat it. Of course, he is just a little hamster, and a dangerous adventure ensues. Imagine a little hamster trying to single-handedly defeat a stuck toilet. I don't want to spoil it. Zeus is, of course, okay. Nothing bad happens to him, but it's the kind of adventures that he has throughout the store, encountering the kind of situations and real life equipment and things that he sees as monsters or treasures or relics. I think that's a good example of the way the world works, really.
It's fantastic. It's an absolutely
wonderful.
Yeah, it's a wonderful idea and such fertile ground, and we can really easily imagine how an entire series could spin out of this really promising concept. Before you began writing all these books, how much did you know about Greek mythology? How well steeped were you in this particular world, or have you had to do a lot of, in a sense, catching up on your own before you could really write about these characters as effectively as you do?
Honestly, so I probably knew about it as much about it as, most kids that grew up watching, Clash of the Titans or Jason and the Argonauts. So I didn't know very much, in the Clash of the Titans movies. For instance, they'll yell, release the Kraken. So I'm like, oh, okay, I got to put a Kraken in the series. And then fortunately, I'm a writer for National Geographic, and they have experts. There's a woman named Dr. Diane Harris Klein. She's a professor of history at George Washington University. So she is the expert for Greek mythology for this series. She literally wrote the book. It's called The Greeks in Illustrated History. She vets everything I write to kind of make sure it fits within, how you go on a Disney ride sometimes. Like, it'll be like a race. You'll drive a race car at Walt Disney, but it'll be on rails, so you can only steer so far off course. And so she keeps me on course. She keeps me within the rails of the mythology. And, of course, like, working with her, I've learned quite a bit. She's been really, really helpful. And another example, I had Zeus. The hamster and all the animals kind of envision themselves wearing Greek attire. And I, of course, just thought, oh, the Greeks, they wear togas. So, in vetting my manuscript, Dr. Klein said, no. So that's a common misconception. Greeks wear something called chitons, which are like capes. It's the Romans who wore togas. And I actually use that as a line within the book as an example where Artie explains to one of her friends who doesn't know about Greek mythology how the hamsters, her animals would not be wearing togas, they'd be wearing chitons. So it's a fun way to try and work in kind of these little lessons and like fact-based things into the fiction so that readers, young readers just want a fun story.
Absolutely.
So it's kind of a stealthy way to teach them about the myths and about history without hitting them over the head with it.
Right. And then, of course, at the very back of the book is a really nice section called The Truth Behind the Fiction, in which you actually spell out some of the actual Greek mythology. Another spread called Meet the Olympians, where they can see each of the actual figures of mythology and hear a little more about the actual stories as they have been passed down. All in all, start to finish, it's a wonderful book, and it's just the start of a brand new series. This book, again, titled Zeus the Mighty, The Quest for the Golden Fleece, written by Crispin Boyer, and it is for the imprint National Geographic Kids. Crispin Boyer, congrats on a wonderful book and best wishes with all the other books that are to follow. And thanks for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you so much. I really had a great time.
Bye-bye.